You're listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Brody Wilson. This week, we have a special Local Motion for you. We're bringing you a regional roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio's Maeve Conran. KVNF is a member of Rocky Mountain Community Radio. It's a fantastic network of community radio stations like KVNF all over the Mountain West that come together to share stories and resources. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a coalition of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. I'm Maeve Conran, the coalition's managing editor, and coming up on today's show, we'll visit an animal sanctuary in Wyoming.
Ooh, here we go. Yes, look at that. Feels better already, doesn't it?
We find out what happens when a rural health clinic closes.
Yeah, it's just one more thing. You're already dealing with enough when you get a cancer diagnosis.
We meet a Navajo basket weaver keeping the tradition alive.
In the middle of the basket, we have the belly button, the center part, that symbolizes Hajine, the emergence point of the Navajo world.
And we find out about educating the next generation on drought and water conservation.
So now your community is in severe drought. So you have a whole new set of impacts.
From Rocky Mountain Community Radio, it's the Regional Roundup. But first, some news from around the Rocky Mountain West. The Supreme Court will decide whether Colorado communities can sue fossil fuel companies for damages caused by climate change. Our rural climate reporter, Caroline Yonas, has more.
ExxonMobil and Suncor argue that both the city and county of Boulder cannot sue them because federal law preempts states from regulating greenhouse gas emissions. But Marco Simons, the attorney representing the city and county, says that the case isn't about who can regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Boulder isn't trying to do that.
It's about providing some remedy for harms that have been caused by companies who have systematically deceived the public about the risks of their products.
Simons says the fossil fuel company's argument is on even shakier ground due to recent federal rulemaking that says even the EPA cannot regulate greenhouse gas emissions. The Colorado Supreme Court ruled last year that federal law does not preempt Boulder's claims and that the case could proceed in state court. Caroline Yanez, Rocky Mountain Community Radio.
Colorado Parks and Wildlife released the latest wolf location map tracking activity from January 27th through February 24th. KDNK's Amy Haddon Marsh has this update.
Colorado's collared gray wolves have pushed further south along the Front Range. According to Colorado Parks and Wildlife's gray wolf tracking map, CPW states that some wolves continue to make broad movements, while packs have developed territory and tend to stay put. Two individual wolves moved separately through several watersheds in the San Luis Valley near the southern part of the Front Range. Data also show wolves moving into southeast Colorado. No wolves have crossed I-25 or spent time near urban centers, reports the agency. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh.
Over 700,000 animals are used in laboratory research every year in the United States. There's an ongoing debate over the ethics and necessity of using live animals in experiments and product testing. But some of those animals do have a better life after they leave the lab. KGNU's Sam Fuqua reports from Wyoming.
That's Bert, a Yorkshire pig who weighs almost 600 pounds, enjoying some peanuts. His favorite snack.
Ooh, here we go. Yes, look at that. Feels better already, doesn't it?
In another part of the barn, a pig named Delilah is having her back rubbed with sunscreen, SPF 50.
Their skin actually does sunburn, and so we want to make sure, since they do spend quite a bit of time out in the sun, we want to make sure that their skin stays nice and healthy and not burnt like we get sometimes.
Terry Brenner is the farm manager at Kindness Ranch. After breakfast and sunscreen, the pigs are free to go outside on this hot summer day.
With the heat, we like that breeze. If there's not a great breeze, we sometimes will bring them in the afternoon so that they can be a little bit more comfortable, because it's all about comfort.
These pigs used to be in an agricultural research laboratory. Now they're living out their days on this 1,200-acre ranch in eastern Wyoming. A doctor from Colorado bought the property and set up the lab animal sanctuary in 2007. John Raymer is the executive director.
Kindness Ranch was the first facility of its kind in the nation. And before Kindness Ranch came along, it was euthanasia followed by incineration when the dogs or cats or animals were no longer needed.
In another building, there's a large room with over 20 beagles, each in their own pen, recent arrivals from research labs. Their size, body type, and temperament make beagles a preferred canine for lab experiments. Unlike the pigs, these dogs will not stay at Kindness Ranch. Instead, ranch staff put them through a gradual process of socialization and get them used to living with humans. Then, each is ready for adoption. John Raymer.
When you're in research, you don't get to learn all of that canine interaction and body language and cueing and behavior. So it takes a lot for them to kind of break out of that shell and grow into the dog that we all feel they were meant to be and not the dog that they were while they were in research.
Raymer says Kindness Ranch has placed over 2,000 dogs and cats into private homes. And it's not only the animals who benefit from being on this ranch. Amber Warner is the office supervisor.
Seeing them happy with their new humans, or going up to the barn and seeing how happy the pigs are, or looking out and seeing the horses just being horses, makes my day. It's my savior, actually. The animals help us as much as we help the animals.
For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Sam Fuqua near Hartville, Wyoming.
Rural hospitals across the region are grappling with rising costs and declining funding in the wake of significant cuts to Medicaid. As a result, some facilities are laying off staff, scaling back services, and in some cases, they're warning that they could close altogether. In eastern Idaho, an anonymous donor recently stepped in to save Teton Valley Healthcare from shutting its doors, but not before the hospital laid off 26 employees and closed its infusion clinic. As KHOL's Jenna McMurtry and Sophia Boyd-Fleekel report, the changes are now forcing some patients with autoimmune diseases or cancer to drive hours to receive their medication.
You have a visitor, good sir.
Hello.
Hey.
How are you doing?
Brad Boner sits in a reclining chair in the busy but organized St. John's Health Oncology Clinic. Small partitions separate five other bays where patients, some on their phone or laptops, trying to work, are on IV hookups.
Gosh, I haven't seen your buzz yet.
Like, Professor Xavier.
Last year, liposarcoma, or fat cancer, manifested as a 5-pound tumor the size of a football near his stomach. After surgery, the longtime newspaper photographer is down to one kidney.
My doctors are... Their biggest concern is just to maintain that kidney function and make sure it stays healthy.
The father of two used to drive just 10 minutes from his house in Victor, Idaho, for a sodium chloride hydration infusion. Then, in late January, Teton Valley Healthcare's infusion clinic suddenly closed. That's why Boner's here in Jackson, an hour's drive in icy conditions. Kennedy Hill was a nurse with the Idaho clinic when it closed.
It was actually pretty heartbreaking. So it was kind of my baby. You know, we started out just doing a couple of infusions a day. We were lucky to doing 10 to 14 infusions every day.
The difficult decision came down to costs. One infusion could be up to $30,000. Like so many rural hospitals across the country, Teton Valley Healthcare faced a perfect storm. Soaring healthcare costs, slashed federal reimbursements, low patient volume, and high rates of uncompensated care. Just over half of the hospital's patients are on Medicare or Medicaid, and those costs can go unreimbursed for a year, spokesperson Nancy Osmondson says.
You know, we were facing bankruptcy a few weeks ago. We were looking at closing our doors.
Once the clinic closed, most patients had to choose between driving an hour and a half to Idaho Falls or across state lines to Wyoming.
That's the crazy thing is like, you know, if you work in Teton Valley, you have to decide between driving to Rexburg or Idaho Falls in a snowstorm or drive over Teton Pass in a snowstorm. And neither one of those are appetizing options to me.
It's no secret rural hospitals are in bad shape. Last year, Congress passed the Trump administration's Big Beautiful Bill, which included Medicaid cuts. Some lawmakers supported the bill because of a last-minute addition of the Rural Health Transformation Fund, almost $190 million for Idaho over 5 years, $205 million for Wyoming. But strict use requirements and timelines mean Osmondson is losing hope.
I'm like, I don't think that we will ever see that funding. So that is not something that we're planning for.
It's hard to tell just how many people like Boner have been impacted by the infusion clinic's closure.
So in a month, we would probably have about 150 to 200 visits. But some of those would be repeating patients who are coming like once a week.
Where will those patients go? Most, according to Hill, have followed their doctor to Idaho Falls or Rexburg. A spokesperson for St. John's Health in Jackson wrote in an email that it also has capacity to take Idaho's patients. About 20 of Hill's former hospital patients now get infusions in their home through Vital Care of Eastern Idaho, where Hill now works, treating
Crohn's disease, MS, rheumatoid arthritis, osteoporosis.
Chemo is also usually delivered via IV, but usually has to happen in a hospital. Boner's work insurance is in Wyoming, making his trips to Jackson somewhat unique for East Idaho. Others in a similar spot could also go to Jackson's Frontier Infusion. It's run by a very busy Hannah Paulett.
I'm the infusion nurse, but I do everything, all the scheduling, ordering supplies, medications.
She takes calls on break from the operating room as a full-time nurse at St. John's, squeezing in patients for treatments on her off days.
It's quite incredible, like, how many people are, like, just totally dependent on these medications to manage these chronic conditions that otherwise they would just be suffering through, just suffering. And they really are just at the whim of insurance.
She doesn't have much capacity now, let alone with new patients from Driggs.
We're not equipped, you know, to take on all of that.
There is a chance the Idaho clinic opens again. An anonymous donor recently stepped in to save Teton Valley Healthcare from closing doors and filing for bankruptcy. Philanthropy has been a lifeline, but Osmondson says it's not a long-term solution. While the hospital looks for more tax revenue or partnering with a larger group, people like Boner are left making the trek wherever they can find help.
It's just one more thing. You know, you're like, you're already dealing with enough. Yeah, it's just one more thing. You're already dealing with enough when you get a cancer diagnosis.
Nothing is off the table, Osmondson says, to fix finances at the Driggs Hospital. And operating independently is no longer feasible. Thanks to Jenna McMurtry for reporting help. For KHUL News, I'm Sophia Boyd-Fliegel.
You're listening to the Regional Roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio. I'm Maeve Conran. A 23-year-old basket weaver from the Navajo Nation has become a master of the craft, reviving ancient patterns and sharing his knowledge with the next generation. KCMU's Emily Arntzen reports.
How do I describe the Navajo basket to somebody? There's a whole story behind a Navajo basket.
Leander Goldtooth is a basket weaver from the Navajo Nation. Right now, he's describing the pattern of the basket he's making and how each layer of the coils tells a different part of the Navajo creation myth.
In the middle of the basket, we have the belly button, the center part, that symbolizes Hajine, the emergence point of the Navajo world. And then we start to have the mountains. There's sunbeams. And then Father Sky, this one last ring. And the last ring that we do has a braided look to it that represents space and the Milky Way.
He's busy trying to finish a set of 7 baskets for an upcoming ceremony. And he says he gets this kind of request pretty often. Ceremonial baskets are hard to come by. He's one of very few weavers on the Navajo Nation who make them. And at 23 years old, he's definitely one of the youngest.
Especially now, there's hardly any young weavers. When I go to like trading posts or even at the ceremonies, they're always trying to find the young weavers because a lot of the old weavers, especially with COVID, a lot of them, unfortunately, they passed on. I'm using sumac. Everything that we use comes from this one plant. The dyes, the foundation, the sticks, and then the splitting, the material I'm actually weaving with is all made of sumac.
He starts by coiling rods of sumac into a spiral to make the foundation of the basket. He then peels other sumac branches into very thin strips. These are the threads he uses to stitch the coils together. He dyes some of them black, some of them red, and the rest he leaves white.
So the black comes from the leaves, the red comes from the berries, and I collect that all in the summertime. So basket making is a yearly thing. Like this material I'm weaving with now, I picked it last year.
For someone who's never seen one of these baskets, can you describe what they look like?
I guess what is really crucial for our baskets is this line that goes from the center part to the outside. This is, we call Ch'ehund'it, the doorway of the basket.
In the pattern, there's a pathway that connects the center of the basket to the outer rings.
So our prayers in the middle, they go out and they go to our creators and our holy people and they talk to them.
Do all of the baskets more or less look like this, or are there other patterns that have other stories?
A lot of those patterns, they're obsolete. At the time of the livestock reduction and probably even before that, around the time of the Long Walk, a lot of Navajo basket weavers were commissioned more to be rug weavers. Basket making became kind of retired, and the Utes and the Paiutes started making them for us. So our designs and our stories that go behind them, they don't use them anymore.
So you were saying earlier that, you know, you've watched your mom weave baskets and then you also had a teacher. Yeah. How did you learn this technique?
I had to kind of learn by just watching from them. I never really had somebody to say, oh, you do it like this, you can pull it like this, or you do it this way. For Navajo teaching, it's all just sitting and watching, and you hardly ask questions.
Is it mostly word of mouth and like talking to people, or are there like books or things in museums that you've seen that, you know, are valuable information?
We don't really have a lot of old baskets here on the res. All of the antique and old stuff are stuff you can find in trading posts or the museums and things. But I made it a goal for myself to collect every little valuable thing from that time, 1800s and even before that time. I've been collecting older and older baskets and pottery, because when I teach my students, it's hard to describe some of these designs without physically seeing it.
Do you teach classes at the school here?
Sometimes I do a lot of demonstrations. Most of the time I do just like house calls. I've been trying to inspire a lot more weavers to actually try it out and do it more, because there is a lot of need for baskets. And I like making them, but I actually just want to make all the special design. And a lot of our people, they want just the standard ones. And so honestly, I get really tired of just doing the same one over and over again. I'm just like, wow, I need to teach somebody else so they can make it for me and I don't have to, so I can have time to do what I want to do.
What do you think is the reason that there's fewer basket weavers today than in previous generations?
It's really hard to teach young kids. It's just not something you just pick up and you start playing around with it. There's a whole protocol to how you properly become a weaver, especially because in Navajo eyes, this is one of the most sacred crafts. And I think that's why a lot of people also, they don't really pick it up because they're actually scared of it. It just takes too long. And there's a lot of rules and things that you have to follow when you make it.
You were saying earlier how there are a lot of patterns that have been lost to time and you have some interest maybe in bringing some of those patterns back.
Yeah.
Can you talk about like carrying on a tradition or wanting to keep something alive, if that's something that resonates with you?
Yeah. Some of the patterns, I really do feel like they should be revived. Those patterns, even though they're beautiful, they tell stories about how Navajos should live on Mother Earth. They really challenge how you think about stuff in the modern sense. And it kind of makes you understand how perfect our ancestors thought about it. And some of these designs, it's just like, wow. Mathematical and the evenness and how they did it. It's just amazing to me. And it makes me appreciate what my ancestors thought about when they made their baskets. So any Navajos who come and sit with me, young kids, just come here, just learn. I can't come to you and say, I'm going to teach you. You have to come here and learn and show me you're serious. Once you start a basket, you have to finish it.
Thanks to KZMU's Emily Arntzen for that story. Drought is on everyone's mind in the Rocky Mountain West, as snowpack remains well below normal and communities face the challenge of sharing the Colorado River with other states during a changing climate. Water issues are complicated, but understanding them matters. Recently, high school students on Colorado's western slope joined local leaders in a hands-on game that let them role-play what it takes for communities to survive water scarcity. KVNF's Marty Derlin reports.
Katja Schlosser works for the Center for Education, Engagement and Evaluation at the Cooperative Institute for Research and Environmental Science at the University of Colorado Boulder. A former educator, Schlosser is also a hydrologist with a focus on snow science. She lives in Gunnison, and for more than a decade, she's worked with North Fork High School teacher Mike Munoz and his students using scenario-based role-playing games designed to make rural communities more resilient to hazards.
Tonight, students will be taking the role of community members and leaders, and they're going to be on kind of pretend basin roundtables. And their job will be to make investments in drought resilience strategies, which is something that our leaders are doing all the time to make our communities more resilient to drought. And then they'll see how that plays out in a game and seeing what impacts they experience based on what they invested in.
Besides the students who had been playing the game for several weeks, community members included staffers from the Western Slope Conservation Center, as well as Delta County Commissioner Wendell Kunst and former Paonia Mayor Neil Schwederman, both members of the Gunnison River Roundtable. Here's WSCC Outreach Coordinator Keisha Anderson playing an oil and gas foreman, followed by others at her table.
My goal is to produce as much oil and gas as possible while keeping my crew and the site safe.
I'm a ditch company manager, and my goal is to keep water moving, delivering irrigation water efficiently and reliably to my ranches and my neighbors.
My role is the U.S. Forest Service forester. My goal is to manage the forest for as many uses while keeping the ecosystem healthy as the climate changes.
I'm a Department of Agricultural representative.
My goal is to ensure that local farmers and ranchers have access to state-provided resources to plan for drought.
I'm the Tribal Water Resources Division Leader, and my goal is to keep water resources healthy and sustainable for the tribes.
Each table representing different communities received 25 units of funding to invest in different strategies to mitigate the effects of drought. Here are a few of the strategies.
Fix and improve local water infrastructure. Establish a new water rate structure. Host a soil and water conservation workshop for local ranchers and farmers. Improve ditches and irrigation systems. Support mental health for farmers and ranchers. Develop a collaborative water sharing agreement. River habitat restoration project. Assess and mitigate fire risk to watershed health.
Schlosser read out each year's new forecast, and each group rolled the dice to determine what new challenges their communities were up against.
A year passes, snowpack is low, and there's very little rain. So now your community is in severe drought. So you have a whole new set of impacts. All right, you didn't get a lot of snow, not a lot of rain, so you all are taking 5 water droplets out.
At the end of the game, Commissioner Kunst introduced a video of Becky Mitchell, the director of the Colorado Water Conservation Board, as well as the Colorado Commissioner to the Upper Colorado River Commission.
The Colorado River is not broken, but we are. The river is doing exactly what rivers do when you take too much from them for too long. It's responding to reality, and right now, for some, that reality is inconvenient. For more than a century, we built a system on optimism and entitlement. We planned for abundance, labeled it normal, wrote it into law, and when the water showed up, we spent it. When it didn't, we blamed the weather, climate change, or each other. Anything but the simple math.
With these sobering thoughts, the game came to an end. Several days later, on Saturday, February 14th, the 7 states in the Colorado River Compact were unable to come to an agreement, and the U.S. Department of the Interior has taken over, saying it will proceed quickly with public comment and environmental analysis. The current agreement expires this fall. For the KVNF Regional News, I'm Marty Derland.
You've been listening to the Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a network of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. Thanks to our rural climate reporter, Caroline Yonas, KDNK's Amy Haddon Marsh, KGNU's Sam Fuqua, KZMU's Emily Arntzen, KHOL's Sophia Boyd Flegel, and Jenna McMurtry, and KVNF's Marty Derlin for today's show. Our theme music is Take Me Somewhere by Joel Adam Russell. I'm Maeve Conran. Thanks for listening.
This has been Locomotion on KVNF. I'm Brody Wilson. Thanks so much for listening. Locomotion airs every Tuesday at 5 p.m. and Saturday at 10 a.m. If you ever miss a Locomotion on Air that you want to hear, you can always find past episodes by looking under the news tab at kbnf.org and looking for Locomotion. Thanks so much for listening.